This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our special Lawyers You'll Like segment, we'll talk with attorney, activist, and publisher Bill Schaap.
Any of you ever wonder why there's a law against naming CIA agents? Well, it's aimed at Bill Schaap, or was at Bill Schaap and his friends.
We'll hear excerpts from a recent panel discussion in New York called Militarizing Domestic Spying and the Boycott of Israel.
If you've never been able to draw connections among drones, TIA CREF, domestic spying, and Israel, you will after this program.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Attorney Bill Schaap graduated from law school at the University of Chicago in 1964 and has been practicing law ever since. Bill specialized in military law initially, practicing in both Okinawa and then in Germany. Later became the editor-in-chief of the Military Law Reporter in Washington for a number of years. In the 70s and 80s, he was staff counsel at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. In the late 80s, he was an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, where he taught courses on propaganda and disinformation. In addition to being a practicing lawyer, Bill was a journalist, publisher, and a writer specializing in intelligence as it relates to the media. He was the co-publisher of the great magazine Covert Action Quarterly for more than 20 years. He also published a magazine on propaganda and disinformation called Lies of Our Times. Bill Schaap has written many articles and edited a number of books on the topic of media and intelligence. He joins us today on Lawyers You'll Like to discuss his work as a lawyer and a writer. Attorney Bill Schaap, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bill, how does a high school guy from Freeport, Long Island, who goes to the University of Chicago and gets a job at a Wall Street firm, how does he end up doing movement political work? What was it that got you started on that road?
Well, it was fairly quick and fairly direct. One of the first big cases I worked on at this Wall Street firm, they had some outside counsel working on it, one of whom was Dave Lubell. And Dave Lubell, who had, I think, been a recruiter for the Communist Party in his youth, was always good at spotting somebody who might be worth recruiting. And he started to tell me that there was a convention of this lawyers group coming up. And I said, nice, I really don't like lawyers groups. And he said, you'll like this one. And it was the 1967 Lawyers Guild Convention in New York. He dragged me to one event, and I met Bill Kunstler, I met Arthur Kanoy, and I met Victor Rabinowitz and all the old-timers. And I'd been on Wall Street for a year, and I said, I didn't even know there were lawyers like this. So I joined the same day, met Bernadine Dorn, and a few weeks later, she called me and said, we need your help. And I said, what do you need my help for? She said, you got to defend a bunch of Columbia students. And I said, what'd they do? She said, well, they're protesting a gymnasium. They're trying to tear down the fence. I said, What's wrong with the gymnasium? She said, you don't understand. I'll explain it to you. So, of course, Columbia was taking over half of Morningside Park, trying to turn it into a Columbia student gymnasium, not a people's gymnasium. The next thing I knew, the whole riot started at Columbia. And she said, as soon as they start arresting people, you're going to have to go down and defend them. And I said, oh, I've never done that. And she said, it'll be very easy. And shortly before the arrests happened, I went to the December 10th dinner, I guess it was ECLC.
That's the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee.
So I was sitting at a
table.
And
they were set up in part because the ACLU would not defend the Communist Party.
That's
and
right.
the dissidents
right.
in the Communist
right.
Party.
Leonard Boudin was their chief counsel.
Yeah. So I went, this was my first legal political thing I went to, and I was sitting at a table with Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy and Victor Rabinowitz and a few other people like that. And somebody comes rushing in and says, we just got a phone call. A bunch of people got busted at a demonstration protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. He was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and he was thinking of running for president.
And he supported the war against the Vietnamese.
He was everything bad about the word liberal is what he was. He was a liberal warmonger. So in any event, they went around the table, and all of a sudden I noticed everybody's looking at me. Because constantly, it was 11 o'clock at night. Constantly didn't want to run down to night court, and Kanoy didn't want to run down to night court. And I'm like the youngest one at the table, and I've been practicing law for a couple of years. And they said, go on, do it. And I said, I don't even know what an arraignment is. And Constantly said, it's easy. Let me tell you, go down there. The first thing you do is make friends with the clerk. Because if you're ever doing criminal law, make friends with the clerk. Go in the back, fill out all the little notices in advance, sign your name on 50 pieces of paper, and give them to him. So I go there. All these people got arrested protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. And I'm looking at the list, and one of the people on this list of like 30 or 40 defendants was Paul Krasner, who was sort of a friend I knew from before. I said, oh, boy, because I looked into the audience, and there were like 200 people there, and it's midnight. And I said, what the – how many – and they're all – almost all of them were Krasner's friends. The word had gotten out that he'd been busted. He was in jail. And
Krasner at the time was the editor of the great magazine, The Realist.
The Realist,
which
was
a political satire magazine.
Very, very well known and very clever, smart guy. So I said, I hope he doesn't – come to way near the end. I've never done this before. And then they call the first case, and it's Krasner. And he comes up there, and everybody in the audience jumps up and starts screaming and yelling and cheering. And the judge says, clear the courtroom, clear the courtroom. Get rid of them all. Get them all out of here. And there were about seven or eight elderly black women in the back row who were there for their sons or husbands or whatever, who were just ordinary criminal cases. And they said, not us, Your Honor. We don't know this guy. We don't have anything to do with him. And he said, all right, the old ladies in the back row can stay. Everybody else get out of the courtroom. And so they call the first case, and it's Paul, and he's standing next to me. And he said, I'm going to get life. And I said, no, it's disorderly conduct. I don't think you're going to get life. And I said, what happened? He said, well, they told me I could have not been arrested if I said I was there as a journalist, but out of solidarity, I refused to do that. So I came up with everybody. He said, but I had a big problem with the arresting officer who really wants to throw the book at me. I said, why is that? He said, well, they have this new thing now. Since at mass arrests, one officer would be assigned like 30 or 40 people, and he'd never remember who was who. And when you'd go in for a first court appearance, you'd keep your client back sitting with like five other people and say, all right, officer, so which one of them is the guy you arrested? And he would have no idea. So they started taking Polaroid pictures of the arresting officer standing next to the defendant. So he'd have them with him in his pocket to look and make sure he knew. And Paul said, so when they put us together for the Polaroid picture, I turned to the guy and said, where are we going after the prom, sweetie? And he said, and the guy went ballistic. So
we're talking to Bill Schaap, lawyers you'll like. Bill is talking about his beginnings as a movement lawyer in the 60s. We just talked about Paul Krasner, political satirist that Bill was defending in court.
Okay, so Bill, eventually you ended up going to Okinawa defending soldiers in the anti-war movement, and then also, I think, in Germany. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was I was hanging out at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I was there one afternoon, and we had just decided that morning that Lubell, Fine & Schaap was going to fold.
That was the law firm you went to after Wall Street.
Right, and we discovered that having no paying clients would lead to bankruptcy. Sure as. So I said, what am I going to do? And I hear a voice from over a cubicle, and it was Greg Finger. He said, you want to go to Okinawa?
Greg Finger was, I think at that time, administrative director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I said, well, I'm open for anything. I said, this is for me and Ellen? She said, yeah, we got jobs for both of you. And the next thing I know, a few days later, I was signed up to be a staff counsel on the Lawyers Guild project, military law project in Okinawa.
And Ellen Ray, of course, is your companion, and you and Ellen,
she was
head out to the east.
She was quickly nicknamed Della Street by the military judges. And we spent the next 3 years, 4 years, doing military law all over the world. That was what got us really interested in international stuff. When we first went over there, we didn't even know what the CIA was, and most people in America didn't know what the CIA was. We're talking like 71, 72. This is long before the church committee reports, or several years. And when you work overseas in that kind of a climate with the military, and you learn a lot fast about American imperialism. And then once you learn that, you learn about the CIA. And that led us to, when we finally got back, deciding to work on originally on Counter Spy magazine and then on Covert Action magazine.
I was a subscriber to Covert Action Quarterly, as was Michael Ratner, a great magazine. What was the purpose of the magazine? Because now you're wearing a journalist editor hat. And what did you try to accomplish with the magazine?
Let's just note that Bill was co-publisher of Covert Action for nearly 20 years.
Yeah. We started it on a shoestring, and the original purpose was just to expose the CIA. We worked with Lou Wolfe, who was an expert at uncovering CIA agents in U.S. embassies, not through any classified documents, but because if you knew how to read the paperwork and State Department things, you could tell who were the ringers, and you knew these people were CIA. And we were so successful that Congress passed a law against us.
Let's stay up. Let's go too fast, because the magazine, it was a really famous and well-known magazine, and there's still people who look at it as this is the highest level of American journalism, what this magazine was doing. And there was a number of years when there were actually incredible lists of CIA people who were disrupting the politics of other countries that you guys published. So talk about that for a minute as to what your goal was, and then the struggle over when they tried to outlaw you.
Yeah, our goal really was to try and make these people ineffective, because the only way most CIA case officers could work, particularly the ones that were assigned to an embassy, was to have to pretend to be something else. They were all, you know, third assistant political secretaries, second assistant, whatever, and those were all phony things. And their job was to inveigle their way into various community organizations in whatever foreign capital they might have been posted, to recruit people to turn against their own countries, be traitors to their own countries, and become spies for the U.S. So we thought that if we identify these people beforehand, it might make their job a little harder, which it did. Of course, the problem was the government said we were trying to get them killed, which we weren't trying to do, and nobody we exposed ever did get killed. But they were very fortunate that one CIA station chief in Athens named Richard Welch was exposed by a Greek group and assassinated. And for a long time, everybody, including President Gerald Ford, tried to say that he got assassinated because we exposed him. And in fact, we hadn't. We later, with the help of Mort Halperin, who had connections to the State Department, discovered cables where Welch had been warned not to move into his predecessor's house in Athens because everybody in Athens knew that was where the CIA chief of station lived. And we found a cable he sent back, said, "I'm sorry, my wife really likes the house. We're going to move in." And they moved in, and like 3 days later, he was gunned down on the front steps.
Now, they tried to pin that on you guys for a long time.
They did. Well, Gerald Ford said it directly.
It's still, when you read stuff, it's still like one of the incidents they point to. There's someone you haven't mentioned yet. I'm interested in what his role was. And Phil Agee is dead now, but he published a book called Inside the Company, which exposed the names of hundreds of agents subverting democracy and unionization in Latin America and Central America. Now, he had some relationship to the magazine, or?
No, we founded it with him. He had been an advisor to Counter Spy. Counter Spy folded when Welch got killed because of the pressure was too much, and we started the new one called Covert Action, and we worked with Phil directly the whole time. He was not the person who was discovering who the undercover people were. Lou Wolfe was doing that. But Phil wrote articles for us in every issue, and we worked very closely with him. And in fact, some of us traveled around the world when he was asked to go to various places to try to expose CIA operations, the most well-known being Jamaica, when the CIA was trying to overthrow the government of Michael Manley. And the government asked Phil Agee to come down and help, and Phil asked Ellen Ray to come down and help them. And once you start exposing these things, they really don't have any defense.
Were you harassed yourself, and was Covert Action infiltrated or attempts to close the paper down, the magazine down?
So far as we know, we weren't infiltrated because it was just the three of us. We did everything. I mean, we waxed the galleys. We rolled them down with them. We did everything. So they couldn't actually infiltrate the organization, but they certainly did try to catch us in something phony. We would get tips that turned out to be CIA trying to get us to print some story that wasn't true so they could then discredit us. No, we actually had more direct interference from the government when we were doing the military law work before covert action. The military is always a bit more heavy-handed than the CIA, and they would plant bugs in our attic and in Okinawa and things like that. But they didn't know we were very close to a lot of MPs, and they used to bring us the transcripts and show us that they were recording everything that was going on at the legal counseling. And I ended up getting 100 court-martial convictions thrown out because they were eavesdropping the defense attorney. And if you proved the defense attorney was being eavesdropped, you won the case.
One more question on the magazine, Bill. There was a point where after you'd published the names of CIA agents for many years, that they passed a law. It was really, you would have to call it the Covert Action Information Bulletin Law, because it was passed to stop your work, which was all taken from public sources. So tell us what that law is and what's been its sort of history as we've gone forward.
It's only been used a few times. It was, it's called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, and there are two parts. One makes it a crime for someone who is in the government, has classified information, to reveal someone's identity. But the second part makes it a crime to reveal the identity of someone that you did not learn from classified information or from your position, but if, and this was the tricky, they put in word, but if you were in the business of exposing these kind of people. And we actually, at one point, Floyd Abrams had gone down to Washington on behalf of AP, CBS, and the New York Times to protest the law. And then he came back and he said, nobody has to worry. They're only interested in getting Covert Action magazine. And I said, thanks a lot, Floyd.
I want to address that for a second because it's a really interesting point. What happened is the argument that was made is if you use these names in a legitimate way, like you're exposing one agent who may have eavesdropped on somebody or murdered somebody, then a newspaper could do that. But if it was the business, quote, the business or the work of the magazine to expose agents in general, although there were always a purpose for covert action doing it, then it violated the law. And they sold that to the Congress and they passed that law. And what the effect has been, from my looking at this, is Michael Ratner speaking, is even, quote, magazines that only are going to publish one name about what an agent's doing in Haiti or somewhere else are completely nervous about it and don't do it. So the law has had what we lawyers call a chilling effect. So you actually don't publish the names, not you personally, but magazines don't publish them. And now what it makes me think of is this new law. They're developing a shield law for journalists. And there's what they call an Assange exception. It's going to protect journalists as long as the journal or the publisher doesn't have as its main business publishing classified or confidential documents.
Right, that's the same
theory. Same idea. It won't protect people like WikiLeaks, but it will protect the New York Times.
Yeah.
So as if there's legitimate publishers and illegitimate publishers somehow,
and
according
to
their policy.
They decide which is
and they and a judge will decide. So so what happens is no one takes a risk after that.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. You will see it on occasion, but usually only if something else has been. I mean, the whole thing with Valerie Plame, only after that was all over the place. I mean, in the beginning, even the New York Times and other papers wouldn't say the name of this person. But once that person's name was in 100 magazines and 10 television shows, they started naming it. But the law itself it's only been used once or twice. Once was in the Plame case. And once, which is very not well known, was a Bill Kunstler case of a Native American Marine embassy guard who had told somebody who turned out to be a Russian spy, I think, who a couple of the CIA people at the that particular embassy were. And it's a very hard case to find because it was a court-martial. It wasn't a federal court case. It was a court-martial. But the charge against him in the court-martial was violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Law. But those, as far as we know, are the only two times it's ever been used.
But the reason it's been used so rarely is because no one's publishing the names of CIA agents anymore.
Right, right.
So it's a big problem.
Bill, you published a book long before I ever met you, a book that I bought and read and cherished about Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans who investigated the Kennedy assassination. Tell us what was behind that, because it was quite an extraordinary thing when you published that book.
Yeah, It was mostly due to the fact that Ellen Ray had known Jim back when he was investigating Clay Shaw, and she had actually gone down to New Orleans in 67 and 68 and been one of his claque of supporters. But then we got a call from Mary Howell, the guild lawyer in New Orleans. She was a friend of Jim Garrison's, and she said he had a manuscript, and he had a publisher, but the publisher had rejected it. They thought it was a little too outré. And we went down to meet with him, and Ellen said, "Oh, Jim Garrison, my idol. I'd love." And the problem was that he had written the book in the third person, and it was obvious that the book should be written in the first person. So we had to go out. We hired Zach Sklar, who was a great editor at the time, and we redid the book, and it became JFK, and it was a bestseller. And we were in Havana. He doesn't admit this, Oliver Stone, but we met him in Havana.
Yeah, I heard that during Ellen cornered him in an elevator.
Right, during the film festival, and she said, "Have I got a property for you?" Because we knew he was an assassination freak, and we gave him an advance copy of the book. And like that same night, he called and said, "It's really very interesting. I can't do anything with it, but it's really very interesting." And the next day he called and said, "Listen, it's really very interesting. Don't sell it to anybody else." And then the third day he called and said, "I want to buy it, but you have to keep it top secret until I do the film," which we did, and he made a hell of a film.
Well, Zach Sklar wrote the screenplay with Oliver.
Right.
It was a hell of a film. It's coming out again, you know, on the 50th anniversary.
Right, I think they're doing
Kennedy
a director's
assassination.
Cut.
In a nutshell, what would you say the message of that film was?
Well, I think there may be a couple of little things that are off, but basically I think Garrison had the scenario down better than any of the other writers about the Kennedy assassination. And he had down about the involvement of the Cuban exiles, the involvement of the CIA, the involvement of some military people. It's not something you can explain in 1 minute, but everybody that's been written about it agrees that Oswald was a patsy, just like he said, and that it was rogue elements of the government and the CIA that were involved. There are Cuban exiles all over the place now. I mean, New Orleans and Dallas and the whole Gulf Coast was filled with Cuban exiles in those days.
You published a newsletter called Lies of Our Times, and it was aimed at the newspaper that prints everything that's fit, the New York Times. But more generally, it was devised to expose government disinformation and propaganda. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, that was in the 80s or 90s, Bill?
It was in the 90s, from 1990 to 1995, I think. We did 6 years of it. It was, to a certain extent, the abuses we were crying about got a little bit less over time, because that sometimes is the helpful result of this kind of exposure. But we were just tired with people thinking that if it was in the New York Times, it must be true, or if Dan Rather said it, it must be true, or whatever. And the fact is, those people lie all the time. If it suits their people's needs. So we had a great run. We had Noam Chomsky did a regular column every issue for us, and we had a lot of really good writers from all over the world, mostly from the States, explaining how stories that had become gospel were really completely untrue.
Bill, you've taught courses on propaganda and disinformation at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and you've been in the field for decades. How do you comment on the American people's response to recent revelations of the ubiquitous surveillance state and really a secret government? Have things changed for the better or the worse in terms of public awareness and response?
I think they've changed a bit for the better. We're still way behind Europe, where the average European is skeptical of anything its government says, and that's not so much the case here. But I think we've gotten to a point where people recognize that the government lies to them. They recognize that there's an awful lot that goes on that they don't know very much about. It's a big step up from in the 60s and 70s. Most Americans had no idea what was good. They didn't know what the NSA was. The NSA was secret. They barely knew what the CIA was, and they had no idea that all that stuff was going on. Nor did they have any notion of the degree to which the government had influence in the media, particularly the foreign media. I mean, that was one of the CIA's best operations, was to control journalists all over the world, including American journalists. But sometimes you didn't even have to, because you could plant a story with an agent in Germany, and then Reuters would pick it up, and then AP would pick it up, and then the story that the CIA guy wrote would be in the front page of the American papers without anybody publishing it being aware of that.
Bill, you started the Institute for Media Analysis to try to give a boost to people that were doing the kind of thing that you and Ellen had been doing all those years. Tell us about that.
Well, we set up, we actually got nonprofit tax-exempt status fairly quickly, which was a little bit surprising. Mel Wolf was representing us at the time. I didn't want to represent myself. And originally, the government tried to deny the application, and they sent him a letter saying, what political party does Ed Herman belong to? What political party does Bill Schaap and Ellen Ray belong to? And he sent them back this scathing thing as the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, blah, 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 blah. And they just backed off and immediately granted it. Now, it's funny because there's all this talk going on now about the Obama administration and the IRS vamping on the Tea Party organizations that want to get tax exemption. Well, in the Reagan years, and the IRS was vamping on the left-wing groups exactly the same. I mean, it's the notion that the IRS is completely divorced from the administration power is nonsense. There may be a few Korea people, but a lot of people come in each time there's a new administration who think the way that administration thinks. But anyway, Mel's letter did the trick, and we got the tax exemption. And then we started, we were publishing pamphlets in the beginning that people were writing for us, some by Phil Agee. We did one by Edgar Chamorro about the role of the CIA and the Contras in Nicaragua, one by Carl Ginsburg about the Moynihan Report and racism. And then we started the magazine and The Lies of Our Times, and we started doing books. We actually published half a dozen books, although book publishing is much harder than magazine publishing. It's a much bigger investment. And since we were, by definition, not publishing things that we expected to be bestsellers, it was a little risky to begin with.
There were a couple of books I remember that were great. One was, and I think the first one you did, was called White Paper, White Wash.
Right.
And it was by Phil Agee. And at that time, the U.S. government had issued a series of documents trying to show, was it Cuban or Russian support for the El Salvador insurgents, the revolutionaries. And Phil just, what did he do?
Well, he just, he went through it and he showed how every one of these things were a lie and some of the documents were forgeries. The whole white paper was a scam. It wasn't very often that the government would stick its neck out like that and publish a white paper, particularly when it was filled with lies and forgeries, but they didn't realize that Phil was going to expose it like that. And then we started doing a bunch of books. We published Ralph McGehee's book about his 25 years in the CIA. It was at a certain point, it was fairly easy to get. We referred to all these people as formers. And formers were getting in touch with us every day. And unfortunately, some of them had very bad manuscripts, but a few had good manuscripts. And so we spent quite a few years publishing as much as we could. I mean, it started to get less important in the sense that the American people were learning more and more about it. After, by the 80s, into the 90s, it was not shocking to people, or at least to average Americans, to learn about these kind of things. In the beginning, it really was. In the beginning, the American people had no idea what was going on.
There's still a lot of formers coming to the fore. Ray McGovern comes to mind, that people who have worked in the inside. McGovern was debriefing George Bush Sr.
Yeah. And Snowden is certainly
Snowden's
would call
another
a former.
Example. Yeah.
And
yeah.
He, I mean, he's doing it big time. He's like Assange and WikiLeaks. I mean, when you can do something on that scale, it dwarfs what we were able to do in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, but you guys were really the pioneers at that point. My gosh.
One of the greatest things about even the naming names columns and stuff is that we were doing this stuff and we didn't get killed. And that was a very helpful example for other people because people constantly would ask us, how come you haven't been assassinated?
The column is called Naming Names.
Right. And Phil would say, I don't think they want to make martyrs out of us. Because people always ask Phil Agee why the CIA hadn't assassinated him. And
he couldn't live here, though. He had to go live in Cuba.
Well, for a long time. But we also discovered when Mel was doing Freedom of Information.
That's Mel Wolf, who's a former legal director for the ACLU.
Yeah, he did Phil's Freedom of Information Acts, and we discovered documents that at least showed that there was a big CIA Justice Department meeting about assassinating him. And it was then sort of covered up, and it came out stuck in a bunch of FOIA stuff. And we went to the judge in the case to try and get more, because these were obviously got in there by accident. The judge said, I'm going to look at this stuff in camera. And after he looked at it in camera, he said, well, I've looked at it and you ain't going to get it.
You know, when we think about that, and we'll, it would surprise me if they hadn't at least had that kind of meeting about Ed Snowden, whether he should be killed. I think they probably came out, well, he shouldn't be, for one, for maybe political reasons, but also because there may be stuff that he's given to other people all over the world and that they don't have access to.
I wanted to ask Bill what advice you would have for young attorneys considering a progressive practice who may be frightened by government tactics.
The fact of the matter is that you, as we know from Lawyers Guild people all over the country, you can be a politically active, politically conscious lawyer and still make a living. You know, you're not going to be like a Wall Street tycoon, but there are a large chunk of the American people who are progressive, and most of them, when they have legal stuff, they'd rather have a progressive lawyer. It doesn't mean you have to defend them against some, you know, big criminal case. I mean, progressive people want a progressive lawyer to do their will or buy their house or do their whatever. And I don't necessarily encourage progressives to become lawyers, but I do encourage lawyers to become progressives.
On that note, Bill, it's been an astounding career. I mean, it really taking on the state, imperialism, the CIA, and one that had plenty of risks with it. So thank you from all of us.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Law & Disorder. You are truly a lawyer you'll like.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Present a few excerpts from a panel discussion held recently in New York called Militarizing Domestic Spying and the Boycott of Israel. We go now to hear David Swanson, journalist and author of War No More, The Case for Abolition, and the Military-Industrial Complex at 50. He will discuss the development and deployment of drones and other military robotics and the dangers they pose to peace, security, and civilian safety worldwide, drawing connections to the Israeli armaments industry and its ties to the Technion.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for setting this up. It's great to be here. I think maybe all of those endorsers should have waited to hear what we were going to say first before they endorsed us, but hopefully they won't be sorry. I wrote down some remarks. I'll try to fit them into 20 minutes. The primary problem, I think, with weaponized drones is that the weapons murder people, and they murder people in a way that looks more like murder to a lot of observers than other forms of military murder do, such as murder by indiscriminate bombing or artillery or infantry or dropping white phosphorus on people. When President Obama looks through a list of men, women, and children on a Tuesday terror meeting and picks which ones to murder and has them murdered, and you can call it war or not call it war, it begins to look to a lot of people like murder. Many of the victims are civilians. Many are men suspected of or just of the age for combat. And in fact, the policy has been to define military-aged males as combatants. and other victims are alleged to be serious criminals, not indicted, not charged, not tried or convicted, just alleged. And they're blown up along with anybody too nearby. It begins to look like the killing spree of a disgruntled employee at a shopping mall. But there's a key difference. It's happening in a foreign place with people who don't look like us or talk like us. I've been asked more than once, aren't drones preferable to piloted planes or ground troops, since with drones nobody gets killed? This is what drones do to foreign policy. They create deceptively easy and deceptively cost-free solutions. The drone war on Yemen didn't replace some other kind of war that was worse. It added another war to the list. Here is the real danger. We're making murder in its most recognizable form acceptable, and we're defining it out of existence when the victims belong to that 96% of humanity that's never been considered quite all the way human in this country, which leaves only the slightest step to including certain traitorous Americans as well. President Obama jokes about sending drones after his daughter's boyfriends, and the press corps laughs. Former NSA and CIA Director Michael Hayden jokes about putting Edward Snowden on the kill list, and everybody laughs. If we can be at war with individual criminals, why not add whistleblowers to the list? They reveal the powerful secrets that give our high priests their prestige. They reveal crimes and abuses that outrage us, but outrage foreign nations too. They open a door through which we can begin to question what the distinction really is between joking about murder by million-dollar missile and joking about murder with an axe, such that we admire one and are horrified by the other. The fact is that the most realistic mass murder costumes you will see at the Halloween parade will be on men and women who've wandered up from Wall Street in their stylish suits. The drone industry seems quite pleased with our acceptance of their technology for murder, but frustrated that some of us are resistant in our own backward, superstitious way to favoring the use of killer drones that are fully automated. That is, we've accepted drones as good, moral killing devices when a human is at a desk to pull the trigger, but we find something vaguely disturbing about the drone pulling the trigger itself. Michael Toscano, president and CEO of the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, says, quote, "Right now in human nature, it's unacceptable for a machine to kill a human being, but he is confident that that will change as we begin to wise up and see the advantages." In fact, there are those who would like to ban automated drones and automated killing robots of all types, and I agree with them exactly as far as they go. Any weapon we can ban, let's ban it. But let's not, in the process, make non-automated drone murder acceptable. If you listen to the accounts of some former drone pilots, so-called pilots who dress up in pilot suits and sit at a desk to fly drones, who drive past a sign on the way home every day that says, "Buckle up, this is the most dangerous part of your day," if you listen to these people, there is not significantly more moral consideration going into the human pulling of the trigger than there would be with the drone pulling the trigger. The majority of volunteers in experiments are willing to inflict extreme pain or death on other human beings when a scientist tells them to do so for the good of science. These are called Milgram experiments, and the pain or death is pretended by actors. Drone pilots do real Milgram experiments, where the deaths are real, the injuries are real, the suffering is real. Drones do not, of course, just kill. They traumatize children and adults. The buzzing overhead, threatening imminent death for weeks on end, is a severe form of cruelty and an extreme case of power over others at an extreme distance, and exactly as indiscriminate as poison gas. Mothers in Yemen teach neighbors' kids in their homes for fear of letting them go to school. In Gaza, people refer to Israel's drones with a word that means buzz but can also mean a relentlessly nagging wife. In Living Under Drones, the report produced here at NYU and at Stanford, I think that report made a lot of people aware of what drones do to Pakistan, whose prime minister today told our president it had to stop. Whole societies are devastated by the ongoing threat and the sporadic murders. Israel has killed hundreds in Gaza with drones. But the drone pilot sits at his desk and follows the instructions of his authority figure. On June 6th, NBC News interviewed a former drone pilot named Brandon Bryant, who was deeply depressed over his role in killing over 1,600 people. He described watching his victims bleed to death and wondering what, if anything, they were guilty of. It became clear why drone pilots suffer PTSD at higher rates than real pilots. They see everything, including the children they kill. Quote, after participating in hundreds of missions over the years, Bryant said he lost respect for life and began to feel like a sociopath. When he told a woman he was seeing that he'd been a drone operator and contributed to the deaths of a large number of people, she cut him off. Quote, she looked at me like I was a monster, he said, and she never wanted to touch me again. Somehow members of the United States Congress, where drones have their own caucus to represent them, seem less turned off, if not in fact aroused. But what about the rest of us? Where do we come down? A majority in the U.S., a shrinking majority, but still, as far as I know, a majority, favors using drones to kill non-Americans outside of the United States. Pew surveyed 39 countries this past summer and found three that supported this policy. Any guesses?
Israel.
United States.
The United States. Kenya. The United States, Kenya, and Israel.
Kenya?
I don't know. And within the United States, there's not a big partisan divide. There is much more concern, however, about killing U.S. citizens or killing anyone within the United States, but less if they're immigrants on the border, less in hostage situations, etc. The first place the wars will come home is in our minds. The U.S. Congress recently gave the Capitol Police the longest standing ovation since Osama bin Laden's Muslim sea burial for what quickly turned out to be the shooting of an unarmed mother trying to get away.
Oh my God.
Congress members are in the habit of cheering for senseless murder abroad in the form of wars. Drone victims are labeled militants after the fact by virtue of being dead. Transfer those habits to the streets of Capitol Hill, and it's easy enough to imagine that a dead woman deserved to die. After all, she's dead. Our police are beginning to look like the military and the public like the enemy. Murderers are cheered if they wear uniforms. Bloomberg claims absurdly to have the seventh largest army in the world. And small-town police departments, with nothing worse than drunk driving to confront them, are stocking up on weaponry, including weaponized drones, weaponized with tear gas, rubber bullets, and other anti-personnel device. In Montgomery County, Texas, the sheriff showed off a drone to the media, but crashed it into his armored vehicle, thereby proving that he needed the armored vehicle. Also in Texas, when the Department of Homeland Security challenged the University of Texas Austin to hack into a drone and take control of it, the response was no problem, and it was quickly done. Is this a part of U.S. wars people are really going to sit back and watch come home? Many of the drones going into the U.S. skies will be for surveillance. A drone can sit too high up in the sky to see it from the ground, but record everything on the ground for hours and hours on video. A drone as small as a bird or a bug can listen to you and your cell phone inside your home. Drones can threaten and intimidate potential protesters as well as racially and religiously profiled groups with surveillance and with weaponry. The NSA has been a big part of the Kill List program, the same NSA that tracks all of us in the land of the free. A Congressional Research Service report arrived at the obvious conclusion that drones are incompatible with the Fourth Amendment. I would add the First Amendment, and I would add representative government. So the fact that the technology is exciting, or that drones can perform lots of useful and harmless functions, is all well and good, but figure out how they're compatible with constitutional rights first, and then allow them in those ways if possible. And if it isn't, then instead of using drones to fight forest fires, let's focus on halting climate change. If we've survived this long without getting our coffee delivered by drone, I think we can make it a little farther. It's not the technology's fault, we're told, by those more offended at insults to technology than by assaults on humans. Drones carrying hellfire missiles over houses on the other side of the world don't kill people. People kill people. But as it happens, drones don't hunt deer. Drones don't protect grandma. The Second Amendment right to an 18th century musket when you're taking part in a state militia does not create a right to killer flying robots. This is a new technology that needs to be dealt with as such. It is a technology of legalized murder. It's always struck me as odd that in civilized, Geneva Conventionized, Samantha Powerized war, the only crime that gets legalized is murder. Not torture, not assault or rape or theft or marijuana or cheating on your taxes or parking in a handicapped spot, just murder. But will somebody please explain to me why homicide bombing is not as bad as suicide bombing? It isn't strictly true, after all, that the damage is all on one side. As we learn the geography of the world by our wars, we learn the location of our drone bases by the blowback, as we just did in Yemen, as we did a couple years back in Afghanistan. Drones make us all less safe. As Malala just pointed out to the Obama family, the drone wars fuel terrorism. Drones also kill with friendly fire. Drones with or without weapons crash a lot. And drones make the initiation of violence easier, more secretive, and more concentrated. When sending missiles into Syria was made a big public question, we overwhelmed the Congress, which said no. But missiles are sent into other countries all the time from drones, and we're not asked. The UN, which has been looking at US, Israeli, and UK drone use, has just submitted a couple of reports on drones to the General Assembly ahead of a debate scheduled for Friday. The reports make some useful points. U.S. drones have killed hundreds of civilians. Drones make war the norm rather than the exception. Signature strikes are illegal. Double tap strikes, where you shoot at the rescuers of the previous strike, are illegal. Killing rather than capturing is illegal. Imminence, as a term to define a supposed threat, cannot be redefined to mean eventual or just barely imaginable. Threatened by drones is the fundamental right to life. However, the UN reports are so subservient to Western lawyer groupthink as to allow that some drone kills are legal, and to make the determination of which ones are legal and which are not so complex that nobody can possibly say. The determination will be political rather than empirical. The UN wants transparency, and I do think that is a stronger demand than asking for the so-called legal memos that Obama has hidden in a drawer which supposedly make the drone kills legal. We do not need to see that lawyerly contortionism. Do you remember Obama's speech back in May at which he claimed that only four of his victims had been Americans, and for one of them he had invented criteria for himself to follow, even though all available evidence suggested he did not, even in that case. And he promised to apply those same criteria to foreigners going forward, maybe in some countries, depending. And remember the liberal applause for that. Never, ever do I recall our demands of President Bush being that he give a speech. There was always something more demanded. And how happy people were this past week when instead of blowing somebody up with a drone, Obama kidnapped them and interrogated them in secret on a ship in the ocean. We don't need the memos. We need the videos. The times, places, names, justifications, casualties, and the video footage of each murder. That is, if the UN is going to give its stamp of approval to a new kind of war, but ask for a token of gratitude, that is what it should be. It might slow down the march of the drones, which is in fact being led by the United States and Israel. Israel developed drones in the 1970s. Medea Benjamin's book on drones begins with the story of how an Israeli engineer who had worked for an Israeli military contractor developed the prototype of the Predator drone in his garage in Southern California in the 1980s with funding from DARPA and the CIA. And the first thing he came up with was called the Albatross, which is not a bad name, really. Israel is the world's top exporter of drones, not the United States. Technion is a leading developer of drone technology, including drones that can fly 1,850 miles without refueling and carry two 1,100-pound bombs, as well as miniature surveillance drones, bulldozers, and other weapons of fairly massive destruction used in illegally occupied lands, where Israel has used chemical and all other sorts of weapons while continuing to receive billions of dollars every year of what we in the U.S., Orwellianly call military aid. So creating a drone island in the East River no doubt appeals to those in the Israeli government who spy on the U.S. and those in the U.S. who spy on Israel, but especially to those who want to legitimize and Americanize the U.S. image of Israel's militarism, to make it as unquestionable in the U.S. as U.S. militarism sometimes is. The U.S. media questions the cost of feeding the hungry while treating militarism as a jobs program, even though programs to feed the hungry would more efficiently produce jobs. The federal government's $1 trillion a year for wars and war preparations doesn't count contributions from state and local governments and universities. The plans of Cornell and Technion to advance the technology of death on Roosevelt Island were apparently approved because of money involved. And in the process, a hospital will be destroyed. That is a typical trade-off. For a fraction of what we spend on weaponry, we could provide food, water, medicine to the world. Many, many more people are killed through what we do not do with our money than through what we do with it in wars. Of course, we could also choose to invest in education instead of in militarism. It is no coincidence that the nation that spends $1 trillion every year on militarism has $1 trillion in student debt. And no coincidence that universities corrupted by military contracts are holding forums promoting war in Syria. An early supporter of Technion who would be outraged by its current practices is a guy named Albert Einstein, who said, quote, "You cannot simultaneously prevent and prepare for war." And he was right. You have to choose one or the other. A lot of people right now are doing so. In September, the University of Edinburgh responded to student protests and withdrew its investment from Ultra Electronics, a company that produces the navigation controls for U.S. killer drones. Here in New York, the Granny Peace Brigade and No Drones and The World Can't Wait and lots of other great groups have been pressuring the UN and the City Council and Congress and drone manufacturers and educating the public. The Center for Constitutional Rights is doing the legal work against drone murder, and it just may be that lawsuits turn out to be a major tool in stopping the drones. An organization I work for called Roots Action has set up a petition at banweaponizeddrones.org that right now has 99,000 signatures. I think we can bump it over 100,000 or maybe 200,000. So go to banweaponizeddrones.org. Where I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, we passed the first city resolution against drones, weaponized or surveillance, since when three more cities have passed them and eight states. But the state laws have dealt only with surveillance, and they have not sought to limit the weaponization of domestic drones, including with non-lethal weaponry. Some of them have made exceptions to their surveillance restrictions for the U.S. military. Four cities is not a lot, and I think one reason why is the complexities of the surveillance issue. I think cities would more readily pass resolutions committing not to use weaponized drones, and I would love to see New York City asked to do that. Even a failure on that question would wake a lot of people up to a new danger in the skies. Drone bases around the country are facing endless protests, as I'm sure Drone Island in the East River will if created. If New Yorkers can chase David Petraeus away, I am sure they can chase Technion away. Nowhere has seen more or better nonviolent resistance to drones than Hancock Air Base in upstate New York. But people have been risking and serving serious jail sentences to call attention and build resistance to these operations all over the country, including in Niagara Falls, where activists are advancing a plan to turn the military airport into an array of solar panels that would power half of this state. As we take on the drones, I think we should bear a few key points in mind. Foreign lives are not worth less than local ones. Killing with one kind of weapon is not worse than killing with some other kind of weapon. Killing is evil and illegal, whether or not you call it part of a war. The killing is multiplied manyfold by the spending of funds on it that could have been spent saving lives. A war is not a respectable activity marred by war crimes and atrocities. War is the crime. We shouldn't oppose waste at the Pentagon more fervently than we oppose efficiency at the Pentagon. If we can stop believing in just torture or humane rape or good slavery, we can stop believing in acceptable war. If the government of Israel makes war, we should employ every nonviolent tool to resist it, and the very same goes for the government of the United States of America.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.